This is an ABC podcast.
What happens when a country doesn't pay its creditors, when it defaults on its loans? Because that is actually going on in the world right now. And we'll get to it a bit later. Hello, welcome to The Money. I'm Richard Adey. We are going to start with election issues because you won't have been hearing enough about the election. So here we go. The NDIS has been mentioned a bit lately. Users of the scheme have seen their packages cut back. The Coalition has queried its sustainability. Labour's announced that it will review the NDIS if it wins. So what are we talking about here? What's going on and how much does it cost? Angela Jackson is lead economist at Impact Economics.
The NDIS is a relatively expensive program when it comes to Commonwealth government spending. So it's currently sitting at around $37 billion every year. And that's going to keep increasing as the scheme matures. We're expecting it to top out at around 1.4, 1.5% of GDP, which will be equivalent to around $45 billion per year.
Right. That is a very substantial amount of money. Where does it all come from?
Yeah, interesting question. So obviously we know the NDIS, which was a recommendation from the Productivity Commission to really reform the way in which we fund disability care, involved a very big transfer of responsibility in terms of the provision of disability care from the states to the Commonwealth. So a sizable proportion, at the moment around 40%, comes from the states and territories. The remainder comes from the Commonwealth. And then we'd also remember, of course, that we all paid a little bit extra in terms of the Medicare levy, that 0.5% increase that came in around 2014. And the Commonwealth's been using that money as well to help fund the NDIS.
Does it need any more? Is that it? Is that enough?
What we've seen is, you know, there's been a couple of things happen in terms of the costs of the NDIS being a bit higher than the government had anticipated. One of those is there's more participants. So more people have come forward needing assistance and qualified for assistance under the NDIS than the Productivity Commission thought when they first designed the scheme. So the Productivity Commission thought there'd be around 410,000 participants. We're now sitting at over 500,000. So that's a significantly higher number, you know, almost 20% more people qualifying for the scheme. The second thing that has happened is not so much that the plans themselves are bigger than what the government thought, but the spending of those plans. So there's sort of two steps, if you like, when you get funding from the NDIS. The first is your needs get assessed, you get approved for a level of supports and a funding envelope. The next is you have to actually spend that money. And the government wasn't expecting people to be able to spend as much of their plans as they have been as quickly as they have. And so we've seen much faster rise in those costs.
You could almost say it's been too successful, but I know there are some problems with it.
Yeah, well, that's right. So I think the question, I guess, for the government has been then, well, how do we respond to this, you know, higher cost than we anticipated? And one of the things they've done is look at reducing the level of those plans. So over the last year, a lot of people have had reviews, and this has been in the media a lot. And on average, those plans have been reduced by around 4%, which doesn't sound like a lot overall, but you can imagine that for some people with a disability, it meant really significant reduction in the supports that they've been receiving.
Yeah, I was reading earlier this week about a boy, I think he was on the Gold Coast. He's got this very rare disease called Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and his package has been cut back by 40%.
Yeah, I mean, that's big. And I've done some work in the space around that particular rare disease. And these people in particular, you know, they do it really, really tough. They're often degenerative diseases as well. And so things change and their needs change. And there is also that concern, I think, with the NDIS, does it respond quickly enough, particularly to people who maybe their needs are changing over time?
So where we are now, Angela, because a couple of coalition politicians have said, look, this is unsustainable. I spoke to an economist just a couple of weeks ago who said, look, this is fundamentally unfunded. We have to do something about it. What can we do?
Well, I think one of the things to think about, and look, as an economist and as a microeconomist, is thinking a little bit about the market that we've set up here. So, you know, again, in Australia, we're big fans of these quasi markets where we put things out to the private sector to provide these effectively publicly funded services. But what we've done again, I think, with this disability insurance scheme is we haven't really set the market up for success. And what I mean by that is setting it up for really strong quality competition, allowing real transparency. So that we can use those market forces to drive higher quality care without incentivizing that sort of cream skimming and that skimping on quality that we've seen across quasi markets in this country. I think there probably is a concern there. I certainly have a concern that some of this real increase in costs that we've seen is potentially due to provider behavior. And there's reasons for that. The price that we're paying for some of these services is below marginal cost. And that might seem like a great deal for the taxpayer. But we know that when we do that in markets, we often actually lead to people skimping on quality quite significantly, maybe saying they're providing more services than they actually are. And we're not necessarily setting this market up for success. So for me, I think this is a huge government expenditure. It's got the real potential and it has been transforming lives. I think, you know, there's a lot of criticism of the NDIS, but at the same time, you know, we have seen a huge increase in supports for a number of people. But really thinking about how we've set this market up and is it going to be successful going forward and sustainable going forward?
Yeah, so at the moment, the market is, it's a bit opaque. It's certainly not very transparent. It does seem to incentivize providers to do things like overservice.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's about incentivizing, and what you really want to do in these markets is incentivize high quality care and cost effective care. And you need to set the market up to do that. And at the moment, really, by a couple of things and the way that the market's been set up, we're not rewarding high quality care. And maybe that's a flip way of thinking about it, is rather than saying, oh, there's rogue providers, we need to make sure that the market rewards those people providing high quality care to drive that high quality, cost effective care. There are other ways and other ways that we could set this market up that might be more suitable to the nature of both the providers and the recipients of the care.
So we don't necessarily need to spend more money, but we do need to perhaps review it and set up the market differently.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think really take a close look internationally as well. This is one of the first markets which have had choice and competition as well internationally in disability care in particular. So, you know, this is new territory. It's got some real benefits in terms of providing choice and control for people with a disability and their families. But there are traps, and I think, you know, providers in particular, there is that capacity there that we've seen in aged care and childcare where the public may not get value for money. And when it comes, obviously, for people with a disability, that's really important. We want this money to be transforming lives and to be improving functioning and outcomes. We don't want this money to be wasted effectively.
I think that's a good point to wrap this up. Angela, thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Angela Jackson from Impact Economics. And this is The Money with me, Richard Ady. Now, who do you think's going to win the election? We're still on it, yeah. Because the polls, well, they may not be that helpful. Hamish Greenock-Roberts, who was at the University of Queensland when he did this research, compared the success rates of polls, prediction markets, which is betting, and economic modelling.
So each of the three approaches are fairly reliable. If we look at the last 10 years, for instance, there were four federal elections, and over that time, each of the three methods got it right three out of four times and got it wrong one time each. So, for instance, if we look at 2019, the odds and the polls famously got it wrong while the economic models correctly predicted that the coalition would stay. But if we look back to 2013, for instance, the economic models predicted that Labor would remain in power. But at that time, the polls and the odds actually correctly predicted that the coalition would win.
So what year was that?
2013.
So I think probably polling is the one that most of us are familiar with. What are the inconsistencies or problems with polling that we should be more aware of?
Oh, Richard, take your pick. There are so many. You can look at sample sizes right the way through to less well-known phenomena, such as the shy voter. This is a bit of a theory that has been particularly explored in the US and the UK, about this idea that people aren't very willing to admit until they get to the ballot box that they want to vote for a certain party, especially conservative parties. Interestingly, in Australia, there's another phenomenon which we've seen called herding. And there's an interesting case study from 2019 which kind of demonstrates this, and quite a reputable pollster actually produced a poll which correctly foresaw that the coalition was doing much better than everybody expected in Queensland, but they didn't actually release that poll. And you'd ask, well, why? And the reason is that pollsters trade on their reputation. So they're always balancing, you know, this need to kind of differentiate themselves in the market to produce the most accurate poll. But equally, they don't want to produce a poll which is so out of step with their competitors, because then they might lose market share.
Can I ask about the economic model approach? Because they got the 2019 election result right, that the coalition was going to win. How did they do that? What kind of variables do we need to be thinking about?
So there's a variety of variables that they look at. The most common ones are the unemployment rate and the inflation rate, but some models also look at variables like GDP growth and real wage growth. And essentially they operate on the premise that good economic performance, as measured by these indicators, will lead to the incumbent being re-elected. So we saw in 2019 there were good economic conditions, particularly on unemployment and inflation, and as the models predicted, the coalition was returned.
Okay, and a bit later, not quite yet, I'm going to ask you what the economic models are saying about this election. But if we go back to last time, you found the economic model and got it right for the 2019 election. But you also found another factor as well, that of the marriage equality vote, that was an important, I suppose, predictor of the result.
That's exactly right. And I was inspired to look at some other factors beyond economic variables based on some research which was put out by The Guardian's data editor, which looked at various economic indicators on the electorate level, like unemployment or education rate, and tried to assign explanatory power of those variables to how a particular electorate voted. And the finding of that was, as is consistent with the general narrative of the 2019 election, is that electorates that had a higher unemployment rate or lower average education tended to swing towards the coalition more. But I looked at those graphs and I thought, I think there's something missing here. And I realised that there was this rich data source in the sense of the marriage equality postal plebiscite. So I thought we could take this as a proxy for social conservatism. And so if you regress the no vote in a particular electorate on swing for the coalition, that actually gives a stronger explanation of that electorate's voting patterns, specifically for 2019, a stronger explanation of those voting patterns than any of those economic variables.
That's interesting, isn't it? It's, in a way, it's intuitive, but it's still fascinating that you found that it was there so strongly. So there is another method that has been used, I understand, again in 2019, and that is called online sentiment analysis. So attitudes that are measured on social media. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this actually comes from my hometown of Brisbane. Griffith University has a data lab headed up by a guy called Bella Stantich, and he uses a big data model to scrape sentiment from Twitter and Facebook and other social media sites, and he runs these complex equations over the top of it to try to determine the public mood based on what people are saying. And he has used this to great success. He correctly predicted the 2019 election result, and he also predicted the Brexit referendum, I believe. But however, it's not completely foolproof, because he also, using this method, predicted a Trump victory in 2020, which
right.
didn't happen, thankfully.
Well, let's go back to the economic modelling, because this is, I suppose, the key question for people listening now. What does the economic modelling tell us about who's going to win this time?
This time, based on the December quarter figures, looking at the inflation and unemployment rate, the models are still predicting a coalition victory. So I should caveat that saying that that may change as we see figures released for the first quarter of this year. We know that inflation will have increased and unemployment might still be trending down. However, they are saying that the coalition will be returned.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm sure people listening now, some of them will be very pleased, some less so. All this modelling though, Hamish, I understand you are slightly concerned. In a way, it's not great for democracy.
Well, I think if we were to perfect it, it wouldn't be that great for democracy. There's an accountability mechanism at the heart of voting, and I think that would be poorer for us knowing what was going to happen every time. As we develop these better forecasting techniques, those also become available to political actors who will always be seeking to sway political opinion. So I think, fortunately, we're not at risk of ever really being able to know for sure.
Right, because we get better at developing tools, and the danger of better tools is that we might know the answer, so kind of why bother? But because the political actors make use of those tools, it changes the dynamics again. So we have to go and vote anyway.
Absolutely. Go and vote.
Hamish, thank you very much for joining me today on The Money.
Great to be with you, Richard.
Hamish Greenock-Roberts. And this is The Money on Radio National and wherever you get your podcasts. Now to what happens when countries can't pay their debts. Russia is in danger of defaulting on its payments to foreign creditors. Sri Lanka already is. So what does that mean? Associate Professor Eliza Wu is an expert on sovereign debt. She's at the University of Sydney Business School.
Well, Richard, it means that the country has either been unwilling or unable to make promised repayment, like missing an interest payment on your own mortgage, for instance. So it's the government's borrowing and they're unable to service that. So essentially not honouring an IOU.
Are there warning signs or is each case kind of different?
There are variations, but typically a major economic downturn being experienced in the country or due to political reasons, such as the war that's going on in the case of Russia. So usually countries are highly indebted, so they owe money in foreign currencies to begin with. That makes the countries more vulnerable to defaulting, but also cases of trade imbalances that are occurring in the case of Russia will lead to currency mismatches. Past experiences with defaulting on their debt is also going to, last in investors' memories and make them wary about, lending further. So, I think poor economic performance, declining currency values all make defaults more likely and other telltale signs.
I'll come a bit later to the consequences, because the first thing I was thinking of was it would be a very different method. I haven't missed a payment on my mortgage, I'm very pleased to say, but I think the bank would deal with me very differently to how countries are dealt with, because countries are countries. But as we speak, and you've already mentioned it, Russia very much looks like it will default. Why is this happening? Is this about the war?
That's a large part of it. So the financial sanctions, the whole suite of them that have been imposed by the international community, has created this serious currency mismatch problem for Russia right now. So they can only generate rubles from their oil and gas exports, for instance, or with the Russian rubles that they've already got within the country to pay up on their debt. But they need to continue to finance what they've borrowed using hard currencies like US dollars and euros, which they're unable to attain right now.
Right, they actually have plenty of money. I mean, I understand they collect the Russians collect the equivalent of over $1 billion a day from its oil and gas deliveries alone, but it's collecting it in rubles, which it can't use.
That's absolutely right, Richard. The Russian Central Bank has a stockpile of a very large amount of foreign reserves, but it can't access them right now because of the financial sanctions that have been in place. And as you say, they're still earning good money from, rising prices with oil and gas that they're selling.
How much money are we talking about, Eliza?
So the total amount of foreign debt that's due is, about $600 billion Australian dollars, which is still less than, what our Commonwealth government owes. But it's not the amount that it's important. It's the fact that they've got, the need to service around 15 international bonds that are outstanding at the moment. So, they have about $54 billion Australian dollars, I should use, to repay in the short term. And so, the fact that they need to repay in hard currencies is proving the challenge right now.
How big a deal is this? Because I keep reading that this is the first time that they've been in this position of defaulting since the Bolshevik Revolution of more than 100 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. Russia has actually not defaulted on any of its international bonds since 1917. They defaulted on domestic currency denominated Russian bonds in 98 when they had the Russian debt crisis, but they haven't defaulted on the international bonds for a while. So it is a big deal when governments do that, and that's why governments try their very best not to, because of the very long-term consequences. So, Richard, you know the saying that, you know, once you're bitten, you're twice shy. Well, yeah. In the case of sovereign debt markets, once there is a pattern of default, trust quickly evaporates. So investors run away and may not return for a long time unless it's for a good deal. So that means investors are, of course, wary of these serial defaulters and will only continue to lend further down the track for a very high interest rate.
Right. So there will be consequences in all likelihood for the Russian economy from defaulting.
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt. And that's why they're trying very hard to slow down the process at the moment and trying not to default. So they're attempting to repay their debt in Russian rubles because that's what they've got on hand to do so.
So what do you think is going to happen with Russia? Because as I understand, we have to get through to early May before they officially default. Do you think that's what will happen?
Not necessarily, Richard. So it is possible for the sovereign bonds to be restructured. Certainly, you know, it has happened in the past. So the Russian government could be negotiating with international creditors to, for instance, you know, exchange their current bonds for new bonds that will be denominated in Russian rubles, for instance. So then it can continue to service that debt. So it depends what the creditors are willing to accept, right? Because they would rather be repaid some amount than an outright default and not repaid at all.
Well, we'll watch with interest. Eliza, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're most welcome, Richard. Lovely talking to you and thanks for having me on the program.
Eliza Wu. Now, we've been talking about Russia. Sri Lanka's in more trouble. It has a debt crisis. And that's exactly what Nimna Prematilika is focusing on in her doctoral research at the University of Melbourne. Nimna, how has Sri Lanka got here?
It's a couple of reasons. There's been very high government spending and in certain instances, mismanagement of public funds. There's a 30-year-old war, which only came to an end in 2009, which meant most of the budget was spent on the military. There was several unsuccessful foreign investments. And in relation to certain mega infrastructure projects, there's a lot of resistance by the citizens, highlighting the social, cultural, economic and environmental impacts of these projects. Then there's been a loss of tourism, particularly following the 2019 Easter terrorist attacks. And things got even worse following COVID, which led to almost about an 80% drop in tourists, and it drained the foreign reserves in the country. Then also as a result of COVID, the government unilaterally decided to restrict imports, which meant that there was a shortage of supplies that was necessary for any sort of production of goods and services that was required for exports. And also as a result of COVID, there's a lot of disruptions in relation to remittances of migrant workers employed abroad. So just in terms of figures, it was reported that foreign reserves were about $7.6 billion in December 2019. And unfortunately, there's only just $200 million at the moment.
Right. So it's a kind of litany of reasons and perhaps some mistakes made by the government to get to here. And the amount of money we're talking about, I think it's $51 billion US dollars in external government debt. But from what I understand, there's actually kind of more debt that we're not clear how big it is that's owed to China.
That is right. I think the exact figure that is owed to China is difficult to say because Chinese funds have come in different forms, at times in the form of foreign direct investments, but they are in fact loan agreements. And there's also been several controversy around debt trap diplomacy, which is effectively when credit a country or an institution offer loans on terms that end up being too difficult for countries to repay, which means that eventually it compels the debtor country, such as Sri Lanka, to accept political or economic concessions. So according to the data that's available to the public, though, the loans from China only account for about 10% of Sri Lanka's total foreign debt in 2020. However, at this stage, it's very difficult to see what the exact figure that's owed to China.
So what about other creditors? Because a lot of the debt's held by international bondholders. What is going to happen to that debt?
So at the moment, the government has taken a unilateral decision to temporarily hold any payment of international sovereign bonds. So there are only three things that can happen if they were to restructure the debt.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing is you can change the maturity dates for amounts of principal or interest falling due under these affected debts. And then you can potentially introduce grace periods. The second thing is you can reduce the principal amount of debt. So in jargon, this is known as a principal haircut.
Yes, yes, where you you just go, well, I'm not going to get all of it back. Yeah.
And the third one is you can reduce the interest rate on the debt. So it's known as a coupon adjustment. And what's also important to remember at this stage is that while there's going to be conflict of interest as to how they go about restructuring the debt, so it's important that Sri Lanka is able to enter into very productive discussions that they can confidently come up with a program to show that they can get the debt to a stage which is sustainable. And that is when the IMF would come in to make sure that they enforce a program that ensures that Sri Lanka is on a path of fiscal discipline.
Well, there's been discussions this week with the IMF. How lenient, if the, I don't know if that's the right word, do you think the IMF will be with the Sri Lankan government?
So far, they've been having very serious discussions, but at the moment, not in relation to restructuring debt. They've gone to the IMF to seek funding as a lender of last resort because they want to secure emergency funding to source essentials because Sri Lanka is very low on foreign reserves and they have no capacity at this stage to buy public goods such as food, medical supplies and fuel. So the Minister of Finance have effectively requested the approval of a RFI, which is a rapid financing instrument. And this is typically against the standard practice, but the IMF has agreed to provide funding to the government, provided that they can propose a plan to ensure that the debt is on a path of sustainability.
So there'll be some restructuring. And normally with the IMF, there's also another price to pay, which I think has been asked for in the past, which is we're going to need some reforms here. I guess that would be the situation this time.
That's right, yes. I think one of the reasons why the government waited till the last minute to turn to the IMF is because back in 2017, the IMF ended up providing what is known as austerity measures or structural adjustment programs. So these would include raising income tax and VAT rates, minimizing exemptions, ensuring that there are improvements to expenditure rationalization, budget formulation and execution, that type of thing. And they also indicate it's important that there are reforms to state-owned enterprises, as well as they were very, very concerned about ensuring the country adopts a cost recovery energy pricing. So if the government were to implement these measures, it would not sit well with the citizens. And therefore, there was a lot of reluctance to turn to the IMF. And it's only now that they're going to the IMF because the country had paid a steep cost previously. Mm.
Clearly, it's going to be tough times for Sri Lanka in the near and medium future. But thank you very much for explaining how we got here, Nimna. Thanks for joining us on The Money.
Thank you. Thanks, Richard.
Nimna Prematilika is a PhD student at the University of Melbourne. And that's it for this week. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. Our sound engineer is Tim Jenkins. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.